know how we feel after we eat, and I know that I ate too much. Joe, I'm going to pull this one with my arm, not in a sling. Yeah. That's about 30 pounds, I think. It's like carrying a set of golf clubs. All right, are we getting sound, you think, through that there? Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds great. All right, I want to give you a couple clips, and I really didn't have time to clean. I had to cut some stuff out and what have you. So, and I did all that. What is that? Okay. Hey, look at that. So it's a little choppy here and there, and I've got to tap things ahead and what have you. But two things I'm going to give you tonight. Number one is how stupid Americans are. And we're going to give these people a break because from looking at the background, it appears they're from California. And we know how dumb people are from California. If you think I'm kidding, we're going to see some things and just exactly how dumb Americans can be about this holiday. And then I'm going to give you a clip from Brother David Barton, who gave a presentation at a church that we wouldn't approve of, that we wouldn't go. But I got the presentation out of that. And you're going to hear some incredible things about the Founding Fathers as far as what they believed. So let me get those lights off back there. And then we will get started, I think. Whoops, there it is. Everyone here knows what 4th of July is all about, correct? Okay. You say, who doesn't? I'm going to show you some people who doesn't. And, you know, to Adam, I think it was Adams, John Adams, that said that 4th of July is the second most important holiday in our history, in our schedule, in our calendar. He believed the greatest holiday was Christmas because that was the birth of the Savior. 4th of July, he said, is the second greatest because it's the birth of a nation. So, but let's look at some of these people here first. We're going to have to adjust the volume real quick, so let's get ready.
Signed the Declaration in 1976.
Okay, I already blew it. Let's go back. It's amazing how everything you try, when you try it, it works, and then when you're ready for it, it doesn't.
When the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence in 1976, what country did we
I'm
break
I'm going to turn this
from?
Down.
Wait, what?
Hold on. This is just her.
Oh, gosh.
What country did we break away from
back
in 1976?
Hang on. Let's restart, because this is too good to miss. Okay, so I'm down here, and you're going to be up back there.
When the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence in 1976, what country did we break away from?
Wait, what?
Hold on. This is just her.
Oh, gosh.
What country did we break away from back in 1976 when the Declaration of Independence was signed?
That's a really good question.
Listen.
You know, we have a big party. Everybody celebrates and gets drunk and barbecue.
July. I love that.
But you don't know why we celebrate?
No, it's China.
China. We Declaration of Independence. We broke away.
I knew that. China.
Okay. When we declared independence from China back in 1776, and Jesse Ventura signed the Declaration of Independence, what year was that?
Oh God.
Wait, Jesse Ventura signed the Declaration.
Yeah, hold on. Just him. We'll get to you in a minute.
I have no
what
idea.
What year was that? The Declaration of Independence signed when we had the Revolutionary War against China.
It's been so long. Right, I haven't had to remember that forever.
Who cares about American history and our founding, right? Talking about the Chinese Revolutionary War.
Okay.
When we signed the Declaration of Independence in 1776 and broke away from China, what year was the Declaration of Independence signed?
Oh my gosh, it was 18-something.
I don't know. You don't know, okay. Have a nice life. when the founding fathers signed the Declaration of Independence in 1776, what year did they sign the Declaration of Independence and break away from England to start America? 1978. When Jesse Ventura and Jack Lemmon and the other founding fathers signed the Declaration of Independence, what year was that?
I don't know.
Have a nice life.
1812.
The Declaration of Independence was signed in
1762. Okay,
zombie.
Hey, what is it?
What year was the Declaration of Independence signed by Jesse Ventura and Jack Lemmon?
1842.
What date specifically? The day.
November 2nd.
Wait, what?
November 2nd.
This is for real. I think it's California.
You got any big plans for the 4th of July this year when we celebrate our independence from Mexico? Are you going to be doing anything to sort of reflect on that independence, the breakaway from them?
Yeah, American style. Party.
Getting drunk and smoking some weed.
Yeah, man. Sacrament, one love.
When the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776, we declared independence from England.
Yeah.
What dates did they sign the Declaration of Independence?
The date? I don't know. Was it 1914, 1876? I don't know.
I bet you don't.
No, do you?
Are you intoxicated?
No, yeah. Well,
we need a 5150 on you?
I mean, really, yeah, go ahead if you guys want.
We need a 5150 on this crackpot here.
Hey, well, hey.
Have a nice day. We're talking about the Declaration of Independence, when we sort of declared independence from Mexico. You're Mexican. Are you going to be celebrating the Independence Day, 4th of July, despite those differences?
Well, usually we celebrate anything that has to do with anything to drink, pretty much.
Okay. So even though, like, your people and my people, you know, battled each other in the Revolutionary War, we could come together and celebrate the 4th of July together.
Yeah, right? It's like people do that in Cinco de Mayo, too. Like
the white folks are, yeah. Hey, excuse for us to get drunk, too.
Yeah, pretty much.
Hey, Mexicans, yay, Cinco de Mayo, let's get wasted.
And usually it's them that are wearing the sombreros and stuff.
Oh,
like
that's
that.
Right. Okay, thanks, bro. All right,
no problem.
You're Mexican. Do you celebrate the 4th of July, even though we declared our independence from Mexico in 1776.
Well, I was born in the United States, so I'm Mexican parents, but I'm an American. But
you
we celebrate the 4th of July.
But so you don't see any conflict of interest?
No.
Because you're Mexican and we declared independence from Mexico?
Not at all.
There's no, you have a, you like both sides?
Mm-hmm.
Even though we declared independence from Mexico.
I think that was wonderful that we declared independence.
That was wonderful. We declared independence from Mexico.
Yeah.
And just become, we can be neighbors now, though. We can be friendly neighbors, even though
absolutely
the Declaration of Independence declared independence from our Mexican neighbors.
We can still be friends and neighborly.
What country did America declare independence from?
Independence from England.
From England, correct. Here we have a German citizen, a tourist, who knows more about the 4th of July than many Americans.
Yeah, yeah. And as I say in some of those commercials, these are not professional actors. So now I'm going to give you a clip here of David Barton discussing what the Founding Fathers believed, how much our society is permeated with the Word of God. And again, this is out of a church that we wouldn't approve of, but we got the clip out of it, so here we go.
Good to be with you. This is a time to remember, to look back. It is a reminding time. And so I want to do that. As we look at the country and who we are as a people, we've had 235 birthdays. We're just a matter of just a few weeks away from another birthday, 236. And we have been a blessed people. And part of why we've been blessed and part of what shaped who we are as a people literally is the Bible. The Bible affects us in ways we don't even recognize today, including the way we speak. Do you know that we have 257 idioms, that is, phrases that we use in English language that come directly out of the Bible? Phrases that we use all the time today that we don't even think about being from the Bible. Look at these Bible phrases, direct quotes out of the Bible. By the skin of your teeth, handwriting on the wall, from the cradle to the grave, a leopard can't change his spots, there's nothing new under the sun, signs of the time, a thorn in the flesh, a fly in the ointment. 257 phrases like that are direct verses out of the Bible. Now, next time you go to Walmart and you hear somebody use one of these phrases, you need to stop them and say, hey, do you know what Bible verse you just quoted? And they won't have a clue. But the problem is they're going to say, no, I don't. What Bible verse was that? So if you ask somebody, you need to know. But see, the problem is we don't even recognize a lot of this anymore. Same when you get into areas of literature and fine arts. I think we all know who Shakespeare is. 400 years ago, he did all these comedies and plays and tragedies. And even now, 400 years later, Hollywood is still cranking out movies that are nothing but remakes of Shakespeare plays. We have Broadway plays that are done Shakespeare. We have high school groups that do Shakespeare. Do you know in Shakespeare's plays and his tragedies, comedy, his dialogue has 2,000 Bible verses in his dialogue. I'll guarantee a lot of folks on Broadway who do Shakespeare every night have no clue that they're reciting so much of the Bible every night as they speak, but they are. It's just that we're not aware of the way the Bible has shaped us in a lot of ways. I love the way that President John Quincy Adams said this. President Adams said this. He said, with regard to the history contained in the Bible, it's not so much praiseworthy to be acquainted with it as it is shameful to be ignorant of it. Now, that's a real reversal. See, today, if somebody knows the Bible, we go, oh, that's, we praise them. We say, that's really good. Back then, if someone didn't know the Bible, they would go, shame on you. You don't know the Bible. How can you be an educated, how can you be a literate person and not know the Bible? See, it's such a reversal of the way that we look at things today. It was very shameful not to know it, but it's very praiseworthy today. We need to go back the other way, where that everybody knows the Bible. Matter of fact, let me show you some instances out of history that we don't think about that may be associated with the Bible. You're all aware of Patrick Henry, and Patrick Henry, that famous speech he gave, give me liberty, give me death. He gave March the 23rd, 1775. Let me just read you the last part of his speech. That's the part that often gets quoted in textbooks. Here's what the speech says. He's talking to this group, and this is St. John's Church in Richmond, and he's talking to the Legislative Assembly. He says, sir, we're not weak if we make a proper use of those means which the God of nature has placed in our power. The millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty and in such a country as that which we possess are invincible by any force which the enemy can send against us. He said, besides, sir, we should not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations and who will raise up friends to fight our battles for us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It's to the vigilant, the active, the brave. He says, the war has already begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace, but there is no peace. Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. Now, that's the famous speech that we hear. And what I just read to you is the last part of the speech. That's 14 sentences. Here's a question I've got. Those 14 sentences I just read, how many Bible verses did Patrick Henry quote? Any idea? He quoted 11 Bible verses from what he just read. Now, most of us saw that, and we didn't recognize these 11 verses, direct quotes out of 11 different verses that he used in giving that speech. But that's how much the Bible inculcated the way they talk. Declaration and the Constitution. But I want to show you something that happened at the Constitutional Convention. This happened in 1787. At that point at the Constitutional Convention, we have the 13 states that have come together. They're trying to figure out how to have a federal government. The problem is they all come. Everybody's got their own plan. You had the New York plan. You had the New Jersey plan, the Connecticut plan, the Virginia plan. And obviously the other states didn't want the plan of some particular state. And so it was falling apart. So on Thursday, June the 28th, 1787, Benjamin Franklin gave a speech at the Constitutional Convention, his longest speech. The convention's falling apart. Alexander Hamilton, they're heading back home to New York. He's tired of fighting with the other delegates. George Mason of Virginia, he's out of there because he's tired of fighting with the other delegates. And at this point, Franklin is 81 years old. He is by far the elder statesman of that group. And he gives this speech kind of trying to hold them together. And this is what he tells them. He's talking to George Washington, president of the convention, addressing the president. He says, "In this situation of this assembly, sir, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding?" He said, "In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection." Now, 11 years earlier, this is the room in which they met and signed the Declaration of Independence. At that time, the Continental Congress, one Congress, had two chaplains. They prayed every day. They had serious prayer every day. I'll show you later how serious they were in their prayers. But he said, "Hey, we used to pray all the time in this room, and God answered our prayers." As he said, "Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered." He said, "In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers were heard, and they were graciously answered." He continues. He said, "All of us engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. And have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance?" He said, "I have lived, sir, a long time. And the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth that God governs in the affairs of men." He said, "If a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it." He said, "I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel, and we shall become a reproach and a byword down to future generations." He closed. He said, "I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessing on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business." Now, that little speech by Franklin, this is just the last part of what he was telling the other delegates. It, again, is 14 sentences long. Same question. How many Bible verses did Franklin just quote in those 14 sentences? And the answer is 13. He had direct quotations out of 13 different Bible verses in what he just did. But, again, we're not used to seeing the Bible in that format. I'll give you one other example. I want to take you to George Washington in 1790, because now he's president of the United States. And, by the way, George Washington says that after Franklin's call to prayer at the convention, they recessed for 3 days. They went to church. They specifically went to the church of Reverend William Rogers, who had a special time of prayer over the convention, prayed that they would get their heads together and come together in unity and produce something fruitful for the nation, and they did. So he's now the president, and he's on a tour of the 13 states. And as he's going from state to state in 1790, he's going into Rhode Island. And as he's going into Rhode Island, the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, writes him a letter in anticipation of his visit. And it's a letter of praise. They say, "Man, we thank God's raised you up for such a time as this. You have protected our civil liberties. You protected our religious liberties. You're a man of God for the hour." And so he writes them back a very kind letter, responding to their kind letter to him. And this is part of what George Washington said to the Hebrew congregation in Newport. He said, "May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid." He said, "May the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness in our paths, and make us all in our own several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way everlastingly happy." That is two sentences out of the letter. And those two sentences out of the letter, how many Bible verses did he quote? Answer is 10. He quoted 10. That letter was nothing more than one Bible phrase after another that he had put together. You see, that kind of understanding, incorporation of the Bible into their thinking and life is exactly why when you look at the Constitution today, if you know the Bible, you find Bible quotes all over the Constitution, all through it. Now, people, "Oh, no, it's a godless document. It's a secular separation of church and state." Sorry. If you know the Bible, you see the Bible all over the Constitution because there's exact direct wording that they use phrase after phrase. See, and that's what has produced so much of the nation. Now, we don't recognize that anymore, but it's good to go back and remember this. And as a matter of fact, we used to know this in previous generations. I love the way that President Andrew Jackson said this. He says, "The Bible is the rock on which our republic rests." We knew that. We knew where the ideas came from. We knew why we were a unique nation. Now, the form of government we have, our Declaration, our Constitution, we've been under that longer than any other nation has been under their form of government. As a matter of fact, there's 192 nations in the world today, and you look at those 192 nations, and that number goes up and down every year. It depends on who's had a revolution. Sudan just split, so now there's Sudan and South Sudan, which is the Christian part. You got 192 nations. We're the only one that's been under the same piece of paper for 235 years. I mean, even if you take Europe, and Europe is considered the second most stable part of the world, that's the old world, and you look at how stable the old world is, in the period of time that America has had our constitution, France has gone through 15 constitutions in that same period of time. How would you like to live in a country where you've had 15 constitutions? Well, we've just had one. Or you jump over here to Poland. Poland's had seven constitutions since 1919. You can be alive in Poland today and live through seven revolutions in your life. Or go over here to Russia. Russia's had four constitutions since 1917. Go further right off to Afghanistan. Afghanistan's had five constitutions since 1923. Everybody else in the world seems to live through a revolution every 20 to 30 years. We've had one revolution in our history. That was 235 years. We're more stable than any nation out there. Sometimes we forget that as we look at the problems we've got today. You know what? We're also more prosperous than any other people. If you look at who we are as a people, America's a small country. We have 4% of the world's population. That's just not that much. But that 4% produces 31% of the world's gross domestic product. 31% of the world's wealth. We don't produce more wealth because we actually have more natural resources, because we don't. South America's got more natural resources than we do. Africa's got more natural resources. We just seem to be able to take what we have and make it go further than anybody else. We're a blessed people. This is why we have the phrase attached called American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism is a phrase that was given to America back in 1831 as a foreign observer elected to Tocqueville. He came here, toured America. He said, "This is unbelievable. I've never seen this stuff before." He said, "This is exceptional." He said, "I don't think any other nation will ever get to what America's done." That's where we get the term American exceptionalism. Now, if we cover this in textbooks today, we say, well, now, students, who's responsible? Who are the leaders responsible for what we enjoy today? And invariably, we'll say, well, the people behind all the stuff that we enjoy, you got George Washington, of course, you got Thomas Jefferson, and with addition to Thomas Jefferson, you got John Hancock, and don't forget John Adams. And so we go through all these names, and that's great. No problem with that, because they are very significant guys who made a lot of contributions. But interestingly, 200 years ago, when they were asked who's behind American independence, they gave a whole different set of names than what we talk about today. For example, 1816, John Adams is an old man. It's 40 years after the American Revolution. We have a whole new generation of Americans who've come along. They're loving what they've got. They go, "Where'd all this come from?" So 1816, 40 years later, he said, "Where'd all this come? You want to know where it came from?" He said, "Well, if you want to know who's responsible for this," he said, "right up top, you have to have the Reverend Dr. Samuel Cooper." And, of course, there's the Reverend Dr. Jonathan Mayhew, and don't forget the Reverend George Whitfield. Oh, and there's the Reverend Charles Chaunce. And he goes through and starts listening to all these preachers. Now, today, we might know something about Whitfield, but the chances that we know anything about Cooper or Mayhew or Chaunce, slim to none. We don't study them today, but he said these are the guys responsible. See, we don't study these guys, and like, who in the world is Richard Allen, or who's Absalom Jones? Who's John Morant? Who is Lemuel Haynes? All these preachers, black and white, that had a huge impact in the American founding, we don't study them today. Although they were called back then, is very significant. Let me just give you one example. Take this preacher. This is Harry Hoosier. Harry Hoosier was a preacher in the First Great Awakening. He was there with George Whitfield, remember the Wesleys, Bishop Francis Asbury, Richard Cook, all these famous guys in that 40-year revival we call the First Great Awakening. He actually drew larger crowds than famous folks like Francis Asbury. We hear nothing about him today. And by the way, signer of the Declaration, Benjamin Rush, went and heard him preach. He said, "He is the greatest orator I've ever heard in my life." Well, you've heard Patrick Henry, and you've heard Thomas Jefferson. You've heard, no, he's the greatest orator I've ever heard. Now, and by the way, see that name, Harry Hoosier? Does the name Hoosier sound familiar to anybody? Anybody recognize the name Hoosier from anywhere? I wonder how many people in Indiana know they've been named after a black evangelist. Probably very few. How'd they get that name? Real simple. You see, he preached all over the wild frontier area. Wild frontier back then was Indiana and Ohio and Kentucky and Tennessee. And he's preaching all. And as he preaches all these wild crowds out there, they come to Christ. Their life gets changed. Their behavior gets changed. They get really converted. And people look at him and say, "Look at him. He's one of those Hoosier guys. His life's been changed by the preaching of Harry Hoosier." That's how they got the name, Hoosiers, because all these people whose lives had been touched by his preaching. We don't hear these kind of things today. Now, going back to John Adams, why in the world would he point to a bunch of preachers and say, these are the guys responsible for what we enjoy today? It's real simple. When you look at the Declaration of Independence, it gives 27 reasons that we separated from Great Britain. As you read the reasons, it sets forth all these rights that have been violated. And historians have pointed out that every single right that's set forth in the Declaration of Independence had been preached from the American pulpit prior to 1763. You know what that means? That means the Declaration of Independence is nothing more than a list of the sermons we've been hearing in church for the last 20 years leading up to the Revolution. See, that's what the founders knew, and that's why they could point to these preachers and say, these are the guys responsible. Now, the 56 individuals who put this document together, the signers of the Declaration, if you look in the records of Congress, the first time that they ever got together is recorded in the records of Congress. It's September the 7th, 1774. And you read the records of Congress, and if you'll read the first time that all the founding fathers, first time we had a Congress, first time they got together, you'll read and you'll say, oh, look, they opened with prayer. And you'll keep reading and you'll say, wow, that wasn't a dinky little prayer, was it? No, it wasn't. According to historical records, the opening prayer session in Congress ran for right at 2 hours. And that's an interesting way to start anything. You know, church would be fun if we started 2 hours of prayer. We don't do that. But Congress started with 2 hours of prayer. And they didn't just start with prayer. John Adams over here said more. He wrote his wife Abigail, said, Abigail, not only do we have prayer, we studied 4 chapters of the Bible that morning in Congress. He said, God so spoke to us out of Psalm 35, just changed our whole attitude. Psalm 35, yeah, this is what he told Abigail. He said, Abigail, he said, I must beg you to read that psalm. Read the 35th psalm to your friends. Read it to your father. Abigail, we had prayer this morning, then we studied 4 chapters of the Bible. And man, you ought to see what God showed us in Psalm 35. And I want you to read it, then I want you to show it to your friends. I want you to show it to your father. Her father was the pastor of their church, Reverend William Smith. He wanted everybody to know what God had shown them out of Psalm 35. And we didn't even know they had a prayer meeting, much less a Bible study, much less God spoke to them out of the Bible study. But it didn't stop there. He said, Abigail, he said, in addition, he said, we have appointed a continental fast. He said, millions will be upon their knees at once before their great creator, imploring his forgiveness and blessings. He says, smiles on American counsel and arms. He said, can you imagine the impact of having 3 million Americans pray and fast? That's how many we had in America back then, 3 million. Now, it's interesting. We had this day of prayer and fasting. That was the first of 15 times that the National Congress called we the people to prayer. 15 times they did this national prayer. These guys were so into prayer that by the time you get to 1815, there have been 1,400 government-issued calls to prayer by 1815. 1,400 times governments called us to prayer by 1815. Now, all this prayer we did, this prayer that John Adams talked about that I'm pointing to right now, was the first, and it was a day of fasting and prayer, and that was significant. Well, we fasted and we prayed, and the proclamation by Congress has all these prayer requests in it to pray and fast. And so after we'd done that, just 6-8 weeks later, John writes Abigail again. He says, Abigail, he said, you're not going to believe what's happened. Remember we had that day of prayer and fasting several weeks ago? He said, you're not going to believe what's been happening. So he goes through and starts telling all these accounts of what's been happening. And it's pretty fascinating accounts because you have to remember, at that time, we did not have a military. We are British citizens, have been our whole lives. The British military is our military. What we're trying to do is build a military, but what that means is you got to get all the farmers and all the school teachers and all the shopkeepers. They got to go home and grab the squirrel gun off the top of the mantle in the fireplace and go out and take on the world's greatest military. I mean, this is unthinkable that we're taking citizens who don't have any military experience and taking on the world's greatest military. But he goes through all these battles that we're winning. We shouldn't be winning. And then he talks about how that we captured a 64-gun British man of war and a 20-gun British man of war. And what really made that remarkable was we didn't even have a Navy back then. Without a Navy, we're already capturing the British Navy. So he's looking at all this and he said, this is unbelievable. So he and several guys were at a restaurant and they were talking about all the stuff that was happening. And what conclusion can you come to? I mean, you're seeing all this incredible stuff. Well, he told Abigail, he says, Abigail, looking at all this that's happened, he says, it appears to me that the eternal Son of God is operating powerfully against the British nation. Yeah, real simple. Only way you can explain this is God showed up, because it doesn't make logical sense. It doesn't make sense in the natural. But we had that day of prayer and fasting, and it sure looks like God showed up because he's operating powerfully against the British. See, that was a spiritual aspect that they saw that we never hear anymore. And I can show you document after document throughout the American Revolution. Just
okay. So, the The Constitution is simply a secular piece of literature, and all the founding fathers were atheists, correct? The kids are being taught in school because they never heard this stuff or were never taught this stuff. So, and I really appreciated the way that he brought out the fact that Adams recognized the fact that God was in on this thing. And that ought to make you appreciate your country. And I know you folks do. Maybe it'll make you appreciate your country a little bit more. So, all right, I think we're going to get ready to get out of here. And we're going to go. I'm going to get the bus started. And I'm pulling this, Joe. Okay. I'm going to get the bus loaded up and get the air conditioning and get it going, get those balloons nice and cool. And hope.